The headlines. The leader of Afghanistan's National Resistance Front, Ahmad Massoud, calls for a national uprising against the Taliban. Iran strongly condemns the military offensive against Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley, saying the news coming from the valley is very disturbing. And the Ghanaian Special Forces pledged to set up a unity government to oversee a transition period, one day after they staged a coup in the West African country. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. The leader of the anti-Taliban forces in Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley calls for a national uprising against the group. The leader of the National Resistance Front said that his forces are present in strategic areas of the valley, vowing to continue the battle against the Taliban and their partners. Ahmad Massoud accused the U.S. and NATO of indirectly arming the Taliban, Daesh, and Al-Qaeda. He slammed the Taliban for violating human rights and targeting the women and children of Panjshir. Massoud also called on the international community to take action against what he called a horrifying tragedy against humanity in Afghanistan. Earlier, the Taliban claimed control over the entire Panjshir Valley. The group said that a new Afghan government would be announced soon, without elaborating. Earlier, Kabul correspondent Amin Alami joined us with an update regarding the Taliban claim about the takeover of Panjshir.
According to Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid, the war in Afghanistan is over because the Taliban are now in full control of the entire country after the collapse of Panjshir into the hands of Taliban. However, despite the Taliban are claiming that we have full control over Panjshir, Mujahid says that an amnesty has already been granted to those who were inside Panjshir and were fighting against the Taliban there. He particularly named the leaders of Resistance Front and Panjshir as those who will be benefited from this amnesty, and called on them, not only on them, but on all those former government officials who have fled the country to return back to Afghanistan. Mujahid insisted that the war has war is over in Afghanistan. That is why he called on all the people of Afghanistan and political players inside and abroad to come together and reconstruct their own homeland.
Iran's foreign ministry says any type of foreign interference in Afghanistan will result in a defeat.
The foreign interference that you referred to should be investigated. We are investigating it. We condemn all foreign interference. Everyone should know that Afghanistan's history has shown that foreign interference, be it direct or indirect, has always resulted in the failure of the aggressor.
Saeed Khatibzadeh said the people of Afghanistan would always fight for their independence. He also strongly condemned the military offensive against Panjshir Valley, saying that the news coming from the region is very disturbing. Khatibzadeh stressed that Tehran will try its best to contribute to the establishment of sustainable peace and the formation of a broad-based government in Afghanistan. He called for dialogue among all Afghan factions to resolve differences. Weeks after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India are demanding refugee status in the world's largest democracy. As Munawar Zaman reports, these refugees are worried about their future, especially the children, amid calls for concrete refugee policy in India.
As the world battles extraordinary refugee crisis for decades, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India after the Taliban take over of their country, they have been protesting outside the UN refugee office in New Delhi, demanding refugee status, justice, and protection for their women and children. Experts say India is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention or the 1967 protocols relating to the status of refugees. Therefore, it would be a challenging task to deal with another refugee influx. In India, where internal migration has been one of the most challenging tasks for the country due to huge population and possible mismanagement of the refugee policies. Observers say another refugee exodus could be a hard job for the country, considering its complex bureaucratic registration process. They say the country needs a uniform refugee policy. As India has no specific program for refugees, it allows the UNHCR to operate a program for them. Based on reports, thousands of Afghans are registered with the UN Refugee Agency, but there are many who are still demanding the refugee status despite arriving in India a decade ago. Experts say now the new influx might compel India to rethink its refugee policy.
Like many other nations and countries, India is home to a large group of and large chunk of refugees who come from their countries of origin to seek protection. But the confusion arises when we come to the mechanism, how India governs its refugees. In India, they have not a sound mechanism which can deal and which can protect these minorities.
A decade ago, scores of Afghan refugees arrived in India, leaving their war-torn country, but they still have trouble in accessing basic services like education, healthcare, and employment. Many are now demanding financial assistance due to lack of income. Others say they would return to their country, but are skeptical and still reeling from the violent past.
I think we have no future as the whole world is silent on our plight. The memories of violence still haunts us. I have a refugee card, but it does not help me as it should as a refugee. I urge the UN and the international community to pay urgent attention to us. We are worried for our future as our fate remains uncertain.
Despite India's rich history of ties with Afghanistan and home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from across the globe, the country has no clear-cut policy for refugees or any domestic law. Experts say by framing a concrete refugee law, India would be able to appropriately protect the rights of refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Canadian Special Forces pledged to set up a unity government to oversee a transition period one day after they seize power in the West African country. Head of the country's elite special forces group, Lieutenant Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, promised that there would be no witch hunt against the former government. The Canadian coup leader, however, said that all government officials are barred from leaving the country until further notice. The elite army unit has reopened the country's land and air borders for commercial and humanitarian reasons after it shut all borders and dissolved the government on Sunday. The army says government mismanagement, poverty, and widespread corruption have prompted the coup. The international community has condemned the military coup and called for immediate release of President Alpha Conde. Iran says the resumption of talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal will not happen as long as, quote, Western pressure on Iran is there. The Vienna negotiations have faced a long break following the election of the new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have faced a three-month hiatus following Iranian elections in June that brought Ebrahim Raisi to power. The European parties to the multilateral accord are now urging Iran to come back to negotiations. The new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, says resuming the talks is on his agenda, but that they should not be held under Western pressure, and the U.S. must first lift all its sanctions against Iran.
We'll never run away from negotiations, but what the Westerners are trying to do, what Americans are trying to do, what they're pursuing is that they want to apply pressure. I mean, you could either have talks and dialogue, but at the same time, if you have pressure, well, what kind of negotiations are they? I mean, we need to have negotiations without pressure. That's not negotiation with pressure. So the threats they're making against our people, these brutal sanctions, economic sanctions that they have imposed, this is not the issue of negotiations. I mean, that we're talking about.
Six rounds of talks on restoring the deal have so far been held in Austria's capital, Vienna, since April. The discussions are aimed at bringing the U.S. and Iran back to full compliance after Washington unilaterally abandoned the deal, and Tehran retaliated by scaling back its own commitments. The U.S. seeks a broader deal that would include Iran's missile program. But Tehran doesn't buy any such notion as negotiation for the sake of negotiation, says Iran's foreign ministry spokesman in his weekly briefing.
The Vienna talks are aimed at ensuring Iran's rights under the nuclear deal, which were violated by the U.S. lack of commitment and Europe's inaction toward the deal. So we are not negotiating a new deal.
Under the deal signed in 2015 between Iran and the six world powers, Tehran agreed to curb its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. In 2018, ex-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, moved away from some of its obligations and resumed uranium enrichment to 20% purity. In the Vienna talks, Tehran vowed to reverse all of its retaliatory steps on the condition that Washington removes all its anti-Iran sanctions.
The new Iranian administration has not given any specific date as to when it will return to the Vienna talks. But what's clear is that the fate of the nuclear deal is equally important for Raisi as it was for the previous government. Except it's not the first priority for the new Iranian president, as he doubts the U.S.'s sincerity in lifting the sanctions after six rounds of fruitless talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israeli police say that six Palestinians have escaped from a high-security prison in northeast of Al-Quds. Israeli media say that the prisoners were cellmates and had tunneled out of Gilboa prison overnight. The reports say that five of the prisoners belonged to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one was a former commander affiliated with the Fatah party. Israel has mobilized security forces to search for the prisoners, who they believe might try to reach the nearby West Bank. The Fatah movement has already hailed the prisoners' move, calling it a slap in the face of the Israeli regime and its military. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also called it a heroic act and a great defiance against Israel's security system. Mona Kandil says that Israel has launched a major operation to find the escaped Palestinian inmates, deploying the military to the region.
Extensive manhunt is underway after six Palestinian prisoners succeeded to escape from the Gilboa prison. Large numbers of Israeli police, Israeli military had been pulled to the area. The checkpoints had been set all over the occupied West Bank, mainly in northern the occupied West Bank, in search for those six Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli police stormed the Gilboa prison, and they would be sending those 400 Palestinian prisoners to other Israeli jails to conduct investigation.
Germany's foreign ministry accuses Moscow of involvement in a renewed cyber attack on the country's parliament. The ministry spokesperson said the government has reliable information that Russia's military intelligence agency is behind the hacking group. Andreas Sass slammed such moves as unacceptable and a threat to Germany. She also called on Moscow to immediately end such activities. This comes shortly after German security officials warned lawmakers of fresh cyber attacks ahead of the country's parliamentary elections later this month. According to authorities, at least three waves of attacks by foreign hackers on German politicians have been recorded in 2021. The weekend flash floods across the U.S. Northeast was an indication of how vulnerable the U.S. infrastructure is to climate change. Hashtag Trending digs deeper into the issue with a review of social media reactions to the story.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. During the weekend, people on social media were amazed by the massive flooding in northeast U.S. that killed dozens of people and left behind a trail of destruction and devastation. Disasters, including wildfires and floods erupting across the United States this summer, is exposing a harsh reality. The country is not ready for the extreme weather that is now becoming more frequent as a result of climate change and a warming planet. New York City was one of the center's worst hit by the remnants of Hurricane Ida. The flooding exposed vulnerabilities in the city's infrastructure, indicating that maybe New York City was not built to withstand a deluge like the one Ida delivered. Our first comment of the day comes from Maps DKNY. 28th Street and 7th Avenue MTA station. Avoid traveling. A subway system built the right way shouldn't have flooding like this. If subways can easily get flooded like this, you can risk running into a mass casualty situation repeatedly. We have a comment by Adele. She said, NYC subways have been closed due to a state of emergency. New York's infrastructure is completely unprepared for climate change. Now, here we have another comment by Emmy Noel. Finally, the subways will be spotless clean. Now, some people have taken to social media to criticize the government's preparedness in dealing with climate change. They blame authorities for spending huge amounts of money for war instead of addressing the vulnerabilities in urban infrastructure. Our next comment comes from Aram Waisi. He said, this is the destruction of the infrastructure of the most famous city in the world. A government that spends huge sums only on terrorism, aggression, and war does not create a strong welfare and infrastructure for its citizens. True that. Journalist Siraj Nurani wrote, U.S. residents standing, walking in knee-high floodwater in an apartment building that was flooded in Woodside, Queens, New York City. And over here we have another comment by Clyde Isman. He said, "We are not ready for the rapidly increasing climate catastrophes. We need a plan." Climate scientists are saying that the world needs to do more to cut greenhouse gas emissions or be prepared for the worst, because what happened in the U.S. could pale in comparison to future weather. Our next and final batch of comments reflect people's concerns over this. The next one by NDP Traffic reads, "How many more visuals do we need to accept that our current infrastructure is ill-prepared and simply inadequate to handle the deluge of adverse climate change impacts?" Now, over here we have another tweet. It reads, "Climate collapse is caused by the massive amount of heat and CO2 stemming from 3 to 4 billion purely systemic and or redundant jobs." Our final comment of the day comes from Peter Glake. He said, "For decades, ExxonMobil has lied about climate change, funded climate denial, driven global climate pollution to never-before-seen levels, and put us in a position to suffer the consequences of their actions." Now, this company is among the 100 firms that have been the source of over 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. All right, that's going to be it for me in this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish. Economic divide.
The report could not be more alarming. The world is getting destroyed through climate change. The largest gas emitters need to comply, but who's listening? Is it even possible to do this in this capitalistic, consumer-driven society? Hi, I'm Kavit Tafwe. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide. In this program, we will take a look at climate change and its apocalyptic economic impact, some of the issues that we'll be looking at. The report by the UN body, which issued a code red for humanity, it talked about irreversible and economic-inflicted effects of climate change that need to be taken seriously, irreversible damage, that is. Also, climate change, how it's going to affect the world economy, the economic impact, catastrophic. The cost, roughly $23 trillion by the year 2050. Obviously, a negative world growth that will happen as a consequence. And finally, we will take a look at a startling piece of news that came out a long time ago worth looking at again. Oil companies' role. ExxonMobil, in this case, knowing the climate impacts of 4 decades ago, promoting misinformation. Is that happening today? Spending millions to promote this. Are they still holding out on concealment? Dire warnings about irreversible damage to the climate. Code Red for Humanity. The group that released the report, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body for assessing science related to climate change. The warnings were pretty clear and daunting. Major climate change is inevitable and irreversible. Humans have caused unprecedented and irreversible change to the climate, unequivocally caused by human activities. When it comes to the future temperatures, warming depends on choices made today. Recently, climate activists came out in London and protested against climate change and how no one is taking it seriously, especially parliamentarians. Now take a look at them here. They have tied themselves to a car and a giant pink table erected in the middle of the street. The activists are from a group called the Extinction Rebellion Group, or XR. They want an emergency response from governments. In essence, they want action to be taken against this climate change and a mass move away from polluting industries to avert the worst-case scenarios.
I'm doing this because I care about the climate emergency. I care about all living things on this earth, and I am doing something about it.
Joining us is Bill Moyer. He's a climate change activist. He's also the author of Solutionary Rail. That's a book on a people-powered campaign to electrify America's railroads and to open corridors to a clean energy future. All right, Bill, welcome. Taking a look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that came out, the first since 2013, found that human activity is changing the Earth's climate in unprecedented ways, with some of the changes now inevitable and irreversible. Fires in the U.S., Turkey, and Greece, floods in Germany and in Japan, and scorching heat across much of the West. The Asia region also experiencing extreme heat. Please tell us about the report on whether climate change has a direct economic impact that obviously could be devastating.
Well, I'm not an expert on the report. So what I would speak to is that clearly the systems that support life are under threat. You know, in the Pacific Northwest where I live, we normally have very temperate weather, and we had a heat dome. I've never even heard of a heat dome before. So with record temperatures for multiple days, it's clear that the report outlines that there's multiple trillions of dollars worth of damage that will come from the devastation of the impacts of climate change.
Okay, Bill Moyer there. Thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it. Indeed, that is something that perhaps many are feeling. All right. The points that he makes there are what we are witnessing more and more of recently, including obviously some of the images that have come across your TV screens, like the wildfires that I mentioned in Turkey and in Greece, and of course the U.S., especially in the West. Or how about the floods in Germany? I mean, need I go on? There's practically no place on Earth that has not experienced severe weather fluctuations.
Climate change is real, and the heat wave affected this. We didn't see any rain to stop this fire. If it rained right now, it would be bad for us.
It is indisputable that human activities are causing climate change and making extreme weather events more frequent and severe.
Atmosphere has been exposed to doping, which means that we have begun observing climate extremes more often than before.
So imagine that the atmosphere has a blanket around it, and what we're doing is we're pumping more and more heat into that blanket. And that is, of course, impacting weather patterns.
The alarm clock has gone off many times. This is probably the last report that will be written before we go through and beyond 1.5 degrees C, unless we act now.
Heat wave in Canada, fires in California, floods in Germany, floods in China, droughts in central Brazil make it very, very clear that climate extremes is having a very heavy toll in the socioeconomic system.
Welcome to our Info News section. Stories new and old make it in this part of the program. Now, our first story is a warning that was issued by China, something that obviously you need to heed to if it's coming from China. This entry title, Protect Your Wallets, is how it was titled, and it said, stay away from cryptocurrencies. Now, why is the People's Bank of China actually issuing that warning? Well, what it's doing is that it's reminding everyone that Bitcoin and other virtual currencies are not legal tender and are not confirmed by real value. So it's something you might want to take a look at. Now, in the meantime, we go to Cuba and a crypto story coming out of there, and that is that the Cuban government actually recently recognized virtual currencies like cryptocurrency. It said that it's official. However, it said that it's going to regulate it. Now, the popularity of the digital currency has grown in the tiny island there, partly because of restrictions on remittances from the U.S. It just shows how U.S. economic sanctions backfires, since now the U.S. can't control the Cuban cash. Our next story comes out of the United States. It's titled Democracy for Sale. This was an analysis that was done which tied corporate consolidation to increased lobbying. It stated that monopoly is a threat to democracy. Basically, what it's saying is that mergers, when they occur, such as in big tech or the pharmaceutical industry and the oil and gas sector, has increased corporate control of American democracy. And finally, we go to this piece of news, which is really quite incredible if you want to think about it. SOS, Save the World. Yes, why? Central banks spending $834 million per hour, check that figure out, for 18 months to save the global economy. That's due to the coronavirus. I mean, that's a lot of money if you think about it. I mean, currently there's more than $16 trillion in debt with a negative yield. So that just shows you how badly the world economy is suffering from the coronavirus. Now, that does it for the first half of our program, but stay right where you are. We'll be right back after a quick break.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. For this topic, we figured it's best to really see if there is a solution that can be key in reducing greenhouse gas emissions to result in decreasing climate change. Now, first, let's take a look at the bare facts. According to a report that was published by the Carbon Majors Database, which was back in the year 2017, there really are a small number of fossil fuel companies. Based on this report, it revealed that just 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. So pretty much narrowed down the emitters to 100 companies. However, it revealed that out of that, basically more than half of the global industrial emissions since the year 1988 can be traced to just 25 corporate and state-owned entities. So you can see that that list is narrowed down, again, these being the industrial ones. Some of those companies that it cited, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron, to be among the highest CO2 emitters, again, since the year 1988. Now, fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years.
as they were between 1988 and 2017, this is what's going to happen. Global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Now, what is shocking is that one of these large corporations that we just mentioned here, namely ExxonMobil, knew about climate change. How long ago? Almost 50 years ago. To be exact, it was roughly about 46 years ago. Now, in the year 2015, another big revelation revealed that the oil company actually understood the science before it became a public issue. The worst part about this finding is that it spent millions of dollars to promote this misinformation about the issue. Now, key question is, how did it go about spreading misinformation? The climate deception dossiers, that's how it did it.
The reality of global warming began making front page headlines nearly 30 years ago. In 1995, a secret memo commissioned from a scientist at Mobil Oil and distributed to many of the world's largest fossil fuel companies warned that the reality of human-caused warming cannot be denied.
Yeah, a rather large dossier that was released and lots of facts in there. As we mentioned, spreading climate disinformation is what the intention, one of the main intentions of this dossier was. Funding a supposedly independent scientist, again, independent in quotes, which is what ExxonMobil did. Another thing that they did, owning scientists who are warning about the reality of global warming in their terms and in their way of presentation, laying out a strategy to fabricate uncertainty about climate change, and that's really important, this uncertainty part. And again, repositioning global warming as theory, not as fact, are some of the revelations of this dossier. And again, we are emphasizing how fabricating uncertainty about climate science is what their goal was. Now, what is actually the main purpose? What is their motto? The motto is, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Pretty stark, right? I'm sure you'll agree. Well, this practice of lying and concealment continues to this day. For example, in the year 2019, it was reported that some of these companies, which are concealing their climate-related activities, they've been accused of that in terms of the environmental impact that these companies actually have. In terms of the number of companies, it was roughly about 700 of them. So it's quite a lot, like Amazon, Tesco, ExxonMobil. Here we go again with ExxonMobil, and of course Facebook being some of those included in some of those companies. So 700 companies. Obviously, oversight is the key question here. But they were accused of things that were considered concealments, such as water shortages and deforestation, which is a big deal when it comes to climate change. Now, joining us for this segment is Juan Pablo Osornio. He is the global climate political leader at Greenpeace. And based on the Greenpeace website, he is the international head of delegation to the COP, which once he said politics is polluted. Also, Bill Moyer, climate change activist, rejoins us. All right, let me first turn to you, if I may, Juan Pablo. The key question here is, companies like ExxonMobil knew about climate change 40 years ago or so. Oil companies understood the science before it became public, and they spent millions to promote misinformation like ExxonMobil. And then 700 large companies later on worldwide failing to disclose their environmental impact. Companies like ExxonMobil again, BP and Chevron. If so, why are they allowed to operate and continue to emit CO2?
Well, first and foremost, because it's not illegal. It's not illegal to stop emitting CO2. And I would put this squarely on governments that are not actually putting in place the regulations that are going to avoid a climate emergency. Building on the IPCC report, one of the things that is very clear as a message, even though they might not say it like that, is that we need dramatic, immediate, and constant greenhouse gas emission reductions. That means no new fossil fuel capacity being built, no new fossil fuel infrastructure anywhere in the world, and looking to phase out all fossil fuel infrastructure by the mid of the century. That is, in 30 years, we shouldn't be using any more fossil fuels.
All right, Bill Moyers, let me bring you in here. That was 50 years ago, what was revealed, and then just a couple of years back, again, Fortune 500 companies like ExxonMobil, Facebook, and Amazon concealing their company's efforts on climate change. Is this about how they can get away with it? Because that's what it appears like.
Well, I think they're allowed to operate because they've captured the mechanisms of power, and that's not a new story. So, of course, you know, it angers me deeply. You know, I lead a group called Backbone Campaign, and we've been in many anti-fossil fuel company battles, from trying to stop coal exports in the Pacific Northwest, of the United States, and some accountability. I don't believe that we're there yet. I don't think we have the social movement power to enforce that, but I think that we're moving in a direction of truth and reconciliation, of removing these, of dissolving the rights that are defending these profiteers who are benefiting in the short term.
Okay, Bill Moyer, they're climate activists. Now, one thing that's missing are the numbers behind, for example, how much money is being lost due to climate change and due to CO2 emissions, in which the next report takes a close look at that.
Climate change is not only a systemic risk that must be addressed now, it is also an economic risk. It could wipe off up to 18% of GDP of the worldwide economy by 2050 if global temperatures rise by 3.2 degrees Celsius. In other words, the world economy could be 10% smaller if the 2050 net zero emissions and Paris Agreement targets on climate change are not met. Under the current trajectory, global GDP could be 11 to 14% less by mid-century than in a world without climate change. The UN Environment Program estimates that the global cost of adapting to these climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. When all is said, climate change could cut the world economy by $23 trillion by the year 2050. Just shows how severe an economic impact global warming has. There is a cost of adapting to rising sea levels. This is one of the reasons for the relocation of whole towns. Shrinking productivity of harvest is another factor. That leads to prices of basic foodstuff to rise. Extreme weather will cause widespread poverty. One of the consequences of high temperatures will be the spread of diseases. Another consequence, fresh water will be in short supply.
Did you ever really think about how you spend your money and what things you spend your money on, and how you are through that in one way or another contributing to climate change as a result?
Death is upon us. The death of glaciers and ice sheets plummeting into the sea, the death of great swaths of forests. It's clear to me what's driving this descent into climate chaos: capitalism. Since its inception in the urban landscapes of England, industrial capitalism has been a juggernaut of waste, driving plunder and reckless production of needless commodities.
Okay, so that was capitalism side of things. Pretty scary, but true. Then comes what's called a zero-waste lifestyle.
This is all of my trash from the past 5 years.
Pretty incredible, isn't it? I mean, obviously very hard to do, but imagine if people actually did just even a quarter of that. Well, one major source of destruction from capitalism, coming from factories of conglomerates, is water. Clothing and fossil fuel firms are the worst offenders when it comes to polluting and wasting water, which came out through a study from CDP, a data analysis nonprofit, which said along with the clothing and fossil fuel sectors, cotton and livestock farming were also culprits.
Companies in the financial sector themselves, companies in the fossil fuel, the apparel and the food sectors represent the greatest impact on freshwater resources worldwide. It's not necessarily new information for many of us that have been working in this sector for some time, but for financial institutions themselves, who, as I said earlier, are not necessarily that well informed on the issues, this is going to provide a breakthrough moment for them to be able to figure out who or which companies in their portfolios offer the greatest chance to deliver that outcome that we're looking for.
Global fast fashion brands are helping drive pollution that has dyed African rivers blue or turned their waters to alkaline. Many firms, including Nike, Lululemon, Chevron, and Royal Dutch Shell, declined to make their data available for this study. For example, companies control or influence around 70% of the world's usable water, either through their direct operations or through their supply chains. Well, rejoining us is Juan Pablo Osornio, global climate political leader from Greenpeace, and also Bill Moyer, who's a climate change activist. All right, Juan, let me first ask you, according to various reports, global warming is caused by human activity and is rooted in a social and economic system that is based in capitalism. Materialistic tendencies, which are taught at an early age, which, as a consequence, drives factory production, hence contributing to climate change. How do you think that can be controlled, if it can?
I think it needs to be controlled for those that are responsible for our well-being. And for me, it's basic that the government is the one ultimately responsible for the well-being of their citizens, for their physical safety, for peace, for health. And they know things that the general public wouldn't know. In other words, what needs to happen is that states need to come in and there needs to be an agreement or a law where you're not allowed to trade or to profit from things that are needed for the safety and the well-being of your citizens.
All right, Bill, what do you think? Is there any hope when it comes to consumerism and, of course, capitalism as a whole and its impact on climate change?
Well, I think we began to talk about this. The problem is that policies and politics follow culture. We have to find ways to reconnect to the places that we live. We need to, like in where I live, salmon are an important species. They're important economically, but they're important as as a central species for the indigenous cultures of this place. Salmon are also an amazing example of the abundance of nature when humans get out of the way. We need to get out of the way.
All right. I'd like to thank both of our guests. That was Bill Moyer there, climate change activist, and also Juan Pablo Osornio, the climate political leader at Greenpeace, both of them with great contributions there. Right now it's time to see how climate change could actually hit the financial system and the very financial institutions that are behind the banks and behind the Fortune 500 companies, and they should think twice for giving them more credit or lending them more money. I wish there was a solution to offer you in my final thoughts as to how we can reduce climate change to zero. But right there, that is the wrong approach. Climate change cannot be reduced to zero. But something can be done to reduce the Earth's warming. For starters, green energy transformation needs to be fully executed, like solar energy. Green energy in the form of electric cars is also another idea. Obviously, that's being currently executed. But consumerism is part of that equation, meaning the capitalistic society that remains under doubt as to whether that can be changed. How can anyone convince these multinationals to not produce as much and for us not to buy as much? I mean, they have shareholders that they have to respond to, and ultimately they need the sales. Who can change that when in Western countries people are brought up to follow and buy and purchase? the pattern, obviously, is to buy, to work, to keep buying, which is what societies are built on. That is the challenge. Thanks for joining us in this edition of Economic Divide. It's a pleasure having you on board this program. Any questions or comments, do send them to us. From Mikhail Vitakhvi, it's goodbye. Until next time.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Iran is a beautiful country with different ethnicities, languages, and cultures. Along with the diversity of ethnicities, people with different religions have been coexisting peacefully in this land. This coexistence has actually doubled the beauty of Iran. I am now in the beautiful city of Tabriz, beside the Saint Mary Church. Today I'm going to visit one of the most beautiful churches of Iran, Sohreghe Church, in a village with the same name. Sohreghe or Sahrol village is located 13 kilometers from Tabriz Marand Road. On one of the hills of this village, there is an old church. The construction of Sohreghe Church ended in 1840. Sohreghe Church has been built on the remains of a church belonging to 5th and 6th AD. Archaism of the building has been made by Russian architects and Azerbaijani masters. The covering of the church's ceiling consists of three different domes: a small dome on the apse, a big conical dome on the central hall, and a dome for the bell tower. This building is brick-made, and the brickwork of the dome is one of the most important architectural aspects of the Qajari era. Now, I have left the Sohreghe village and I'm setting off to the Sohreghe church. There are green, beautiful meadows with hills full of flowers around as far as the eye could see. And after climbing this small hill, there is a big hill where the church is located. Thank you. my God! It's incredible! One of the most beautiful sceneries I've ever seen in whole of my life. Sohrege Church is shining like a red gem in the middle of the green hills. Oh, I must take photos from this dazzling scenery. Though even the most and best photos can't exactly describe the beauty and grandeur of this region. And I am now inside the Sohrege Church. This church consists of three parts: the entrance, the central hall, and the apse. Here is the central hall of the church, which is built in a rectangular shape. The ceiling of the building is dome-like. And here, there is a brick-made balcony, which has two staircases. These staircases end in the bell tower. I wish I could go up the stairs, but actually I'm really tired to do so. You know, I have walked a long way to get here. Sohrege Church was severely damaged after the 1936 earthquake, and what is left from that era is one of the examples of the rich architecture of Azerbaijan. Oh well, there are some benches outside the church, which I'm going to take a rest on one of them and watch the stunning building of Sohrege Church with the hills around.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: 31 meters, 9,855 kHz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.